Testimony of Light, by Helen Greaves. About the author. Helen Greaves lived in the United Kingdom and was the author of several books of metaphysics, including The Challenging Light, The Dissolving Veil, and The Wheel of Eternity. Testimony of Light has remained in print since it was first published in 1969, and it has touched the lives of many. Telepathy between the living is now generally accepted, but telepathy between the living and the so-called dead is both more doubtful and less common. The highest level of communication is undoubtedly that by telepathy, and this remarkable book is an outstanding example of communion between the minds of two close friends on either side of the veil. Those who have known both Helen Greaves and the late Francis Banks, and their respective writings, are impressed by the authenticity of these scripts. Their phrasing and contents are typical of Miss Banks, as they are completely unlike the style of writing shown by the author in her previous books and articles. Francis Banks' message, that the death of the body is but a gentle passing to a much freer and fuller life, presents itself with great clarity and conviction. The book is a true story about a friendship between two women that endures after one of them passes away. Francis Banks died, as she had lived, fully aware of what she was experiencing and where she hoped to go. Her friend Helen Greaves was by her side as she finally lapsed into unconsciousness. Then, one evening some 3 weeks after Francis's death, Helen sensed her presence. This extraordinary encounter marked the beginning of contact between them from both sides of the veil between life as we know it and life on the other side. The book begins with a brief biographical introduction followed by a description of Francis' return to the spheres of the spirit. The rest of the book consists of the actual scripts provided by Francis. I think anyone interested in the afterlife will find this book very interesting. The descriptions in the book about heaven and what happens after we die are definitely attractive, and they make death seem something to look forward to, instead of being dreaded. The important message that the author attempts to portray is that the death of the body is simply a gentle passing to a much freer and fuller life. Stuart thinks books like this are fictitious nonsense written by people out to make a few bucks. I definitely lean in this direction as well, but I read for entertainment, and this book definitely got me thinking and I enjoyed reading it, so I'd say that it wasn't a waste of money and so it served its purpose. Definitely not a book for everyone though. The book begins with Helen's description of Francis' last days and her death. Then it quickly moves to a re-establishment of the previously strong telepathic link between the two women. Helen became aware at first of a presence about 3 weeks after Francis' death. Then some days later she felt the telepathic link with Francis' mind impinge on her own. It became apparent that it was Francis' intention to dictate the story of her after-death experiences to and through her friend, Helen Greaves. Helen reports, now that she was evidently restored to consciousness and awareness after the change into her new life, the first burning desire would be to make known all that was happening, and to send back at first hand. For Helen, it was almost as though I took dictation. Apparently, this activity was not just the desire of Francis to tell her story, but as she explained later, she was under the inspiration of a group, or band, for this transmitting of her impressions of the life beyond to be translated into a book. We may infer from this that some entities in the afterworld wanted to send this information back to humans on Earth as a helpful service to them. This idea of service to others is a major theme throughout the book. And so the dictation to Helen began on December 5, 1965, and continued on a fairly regular basis for the next 2 years. From this process we, the readers, have an intense description of the day-to-day, week-to-week progress of Francis' experiences and journey in the afterlife. In every case we find her experiences fascinating, inspiring, and consoling. In order to gain all the insights and information about the afterlife as shared by Francis, one needs to read the entire book. That is an easy task as it is only 160 pages in length. But we can discuss some of the major themes that are explored in this delightful work. 1. The newly transitioned individuals receive appropriate healing while they become accustomed to the changes in their consciousness. 2. As they settle in, they move to their appropriate place in the spiritual world. 3. One moves forward spiritually through service to others. 4. Everyone belongs to a group, actually many different kinds of groups. 5. The extent of life after life is endless. Probably most people wonder, what will happen to me when I die? The story of Francis is very reassuring. Every individual who crosses over, with a few exceptions explained in the book, will receive immediate, kind, loving care. Francis wakes up in a kind of rest home run by the sisters of the community to which she belonged when in incarnation, and under the care of her former mother Superior Florence and Anglican priest, Father Joseph. She needed some time to recuperate from her illness. She learns that souls are brought here from Earth and from other places. They are nursed and taken care of here, as am I. We learn from Francis' reports to and through author Helen Greaves that individuals come and go after different intervals. This portion of the book is intensely interesting as we meet the various individuals who pass through the rest home hospital. Each is cared for in relation to their needs. Some stay for relatively short periods and others remain for a long time. Francis tries to explain how time doesn't really exist in the afterlife, but she needs to use those terms to explain processes to readers. As Francis adjusts to the energies and different consciousness there, she feels great joy to learn that one can still exercise one's skills in this new life. She chooses to help out at the rest home and to use her teaching and tutoring skills. Each day she learns more and more. She says the early days are a stretching of the mind period. She is still herself, but she now views her problems and hopes from an entirely different angle and with far greater dawning comprehension. Many students of metaphysics have heard of a life review, that intense reviewing of one's earthly life in order to perceive what one did right or wrong. Francis notes, there is no compulsion to review one's past life on Earth as soon as one arrives. Some take a long time to tackle the problem. She does report her own shock when she starts to review her life, a true humbling of yourself to find that you did so little when you would have done so much, that you went wrong so often when you were sure you were right. The various patients that pass through the rest home provide learning experiences for both Francis and the readers of the book. They range from Dr. X, who believed his life to have been a failure, but who had actually achieved much and was an old, advanced soul, to a man who had been a Nazi leader who had committed suicide. He had been rescued from where he had been wandering in the lower places, imprisoned by his own evil. Francis says, he has come to us to be healed. He will spend a long time in a kind of sleep state. Another lovely temporary visit in the rest home is a young child who quickly moves on to join family members. And so we learn through Francis' experiences that every individual has an appropriate place in the afterlife, a place of great love and comfort. We also learn that each one has many opportunities to learn and evolve spiritually in order to progress to higher and higher spiritual levels. Often this progress involves various kinds of service to others, often utilizing one's already developed talents and skills. Francis reports that bit by bit, we move away from Earth ideas and limitations, and advance more into light and wisdom. Francis learns, with some humility and dismay, that one cannot leap up to high spiritual levels of vibration in one jump. It is a gradual, step-by-step process that one moves through. Each step of advancement must be earned. She reports, the planes of the spirit stretch onward into infinity. You can't push yourself into heavens beyond you. The law of progression is exact. In the afterlife, the newly transported soul graduates always to the rightful place it has earned and prepared. Gradually, with each experience Francis has, she grows in understanding. She says, we have to learn to live in this new frequency, to guard the doors of one's mind. Here the thought pattern is determinant of one's welfare, one's progress, one's happiness and joy. Every soul must assimilate the way before proceeding onward into planes of even higher frequencies. Francis continues to teach and learn. She works with many who arrive expecting to find what Francis terms a super welfare state, a heaven of utter delight in which no efforts would ever be needed by them. Many expect to rest in the arms of Jesus. Now Frances had spent much of her earthly life within a Christian religious organization. But here she has learned that Lord Jesus lives in a plane far beyond this, where she is. Moreover, she has learned that no soul coming here from Earth's limitations, however advanced it may be in spiritual truth, is able to stand the stepped-up vibrations or the translucent light of these high planes. One has to earn every step of advancement. Over time, Frances comes to comprehend the importance of groups. She sees that our patients stay with us until they have adjusted to this new life and are ready to join their dear ones or their special groups. She notes how on Earth individuality tends to be emphasized and society has largely downplayed the significance of groups. She says, "We are, to my limited knowledge, all members not of one group, but of many, and the many make up the great group or the great soul being in which we live and move and have our being." She then identifies some of the groups to which we belong. First, we belong to a family group. The next groups are groups of interest, such as the arts, music, education, social sciences and social service. When souls arrive in the afterlife and have cleared the receiving houses, like the rest home where Frances serves, they pass on to, first, the family and then later to the special group of their interests. There are groups at higher levels that Frances equates to advanced classes in a university. Those groups are guided by great beings, who watch over the progress of their cell-like clusters of souls. Beyond these groups are other greater groups. All is progress. Life is a continuing path towards one's particular group. This unique, remarkable little book provides readers with endless insight and inspiration. Each page is so rich that it is impossible in a book discussion such as this to do more than just touch upon a few of its treasures. I have read it twice and intend to repeat it again and again. No one can fear death after reading this book. The same goes for life on Earth, because the book shows how here we also have opportunities to learn and grow in ways that we can continue to utilize in the afterlife. There is no end to the all that is. A good way to conclude our journey through Helene Greaves and Frances Banks' testimony of light is to note just a few words of wisdom that touch our soul in this book. Frances summarizes the message which we want to put across in this work. 1. There should be no fear of death, for the death of the body is but a gentle passing to a much freer life. 2. That all life is lived as a serial, that we go from one experience of living to another experience of living at a different rate, that is, on a higher level of awareness. 3. That much of what we thought praiseworthy on earth is mediocre to us in the light of wider knowledge, and conversely much for which we blamed ourselves and were blamed by others, is viewed here from a wider angle and even becomes merit. This wonderful book assures us that all is order, advancement, progress, and all is unity. On the book Testimony of Light from Michael Prescott blog. Another excerpt from Testimony of Light, by Helene Greaves, a book of purportedly channeled communications from a discarnate soul. Ellipses, in original, abridgments and additions indicated by square brackets. Reality. What is it? What an illusion thought it is. I thought I was real enough on Earth. Now I realize that what seemed important and substantial and worthwhile was but a shadow of a shadow. I'm not really real here. This too is merely the shadow which is but a shell, or covering, of something else. I'm on a journey still. Perhaps to the center, certainly to a higher point, but what this is I scarcely dare imagine. I've only peeled off the outer shadow yet, the outer skin. Rather like peeling skins from an onion. One goes on shedding, it seems an eternal process. The planes of the spirit stretch onward into infinity. What joy it will be, going forwards, gravitating, even though slowly, to one's true place. I presume each plane will seem real, will have more reality than the preceding one. That sounds like a paradox. But reality itself? It is quite beyond our comprehension. But I am trying to shed some of the clutter of personality. We all have to do that. And there are three ways in which to carry it out here. By self-judgment, and true assessment of experiences, by service to one's fellows, and by aspiration. But oh, with so many, many compensations. I can express it best in this thought: the subjective of the earth plane mind has become the objective in this new state of being. This I begin to comprehend, is the law of progress. By it we advance onwards into realms of incredible beauty and wonder. How can I make this clear? The subjective or inner content of my thoughts, aspirations and desires here and now will fashion the objective place to which I will pass on the next stage of my journey, just as the inner life of the soul within the body-mind on earth decides the first future home on this, post-mortem, level. More and more important therefore and invaluable, is the inner life of meditation and contemplation and at-one-ment with divine beauty and truth. The saying on earth, as a man thinks, so is he, is true in essence, truer than our ideas can conceive. By man's thoughts and inspirations he weaves for himself his future place in this dimension. This is logical law. In the earth life he can build a far tilde section aid about himself. Here he is no such mask. He is known here for what he is, and for what his inner subjective life has made him. p. 5961, Betty, a PhD in theology, teaches religious studies at California State University and has a special interest in mediumship. In his concluding chapter, Professor Betty writes, "I wish I could report that there was unanimity on this very important subject, of reincarnation, but the facts don't permit it. This lack is the main reason I leave open the possibility, however slight, that this entire literature could be coming from the subconscious beliefs of mediums rather than from spirits. There are many reasons for thinking otherwise, and they impress me far more than this lone thorn among so many flowers growing together harmoniously, but there is no denying the prick." Still, Betty's own book showed me that explicit references to reincarnation are found in some of the oldest modern mediumistic accounts. It does not appear to be the case, as I'd previously believed, that reincarnation scarcely makes an appearance in the older messages but starts appearing regularly in the more recent ones. Instead, there seems to have been a certain tension over this issue right from the start. I was already somewhat aware of this, having read the Spirit's book. This well-known volume was compiled by Alan Kardec and originally published in 1857, not too long after the modern spiritualist movement began. Kardec's communicating spirits make no bones, so to speak, about reincarnation, which they view as a natural part of any spirit's evolution. Asked, how can the soul that has not attained to perfection during the corporeal life complete the work of its purification? The spirits answer, by undergoing the trial of a new existence, a broken bar. Additional questioning brings out the clarification that the new existence must be a physical one. The soul, in purifying itself, undoubtedly undergoes a transformation. But, in order to effect this transformation, it needs the trial of corporeal life, a broken bar. We all have many such existences. Those who maintain the contrary wish to keep you in the same ignorance in which they are themselves a broken bar. In each new existence, a spirit takes a step forwards in the path of progress, when he has stripped himself of all his impurities. He has no further need of the trials of corporeal life. A broken bar, he who advances quickly spares himself many trials. Nevertheless, these successive incarnations are always very numerous, for progress is almost infinite. Returning to Stafford Betty's book, we find a discussion of reincarnation in his chapter on the 1914 book Letters from the Afterlife, in which Elsa Barker channeled Judge David Hatch. The discarnate Hatch tells us, "You should get away from the mental habit of regarding your present life as the only one, get rid of the idea that the life you expect to lead on this side, after your death, is to be an endless existence in one state. You could no more endure such an endless existence in the subtle matter, of Hatch's world, than you could endure to live forever in the gross matter in which you are now encased. You would weary of it. You could not support it." A broken bar, I could probably force the coming back, to earth, but that would be unwise, for I should then come back with less power than I want. A broken bar, it is better for me to rest in the condition of light matter until I have accumulated energy enough to come back with power. I shall not do, however, as many souls do. They stay out here until they are as tired of this world as they formerly were tired of the earth, and then are driven back half unconsciously by the irresistible force of the tide of rhythm. I want to guide to that rhythm a broken bar. When the soul enters matter, preparing for rebirth, it enters potentiality, if we may use such a term, and all its strength is needed in the Herculean effort to form the new body and adjust to it. Hatch goes on to explain that AF tendencies of any given life, the unexplained impulses and desires, were in nearly all cases brought over to the new incarnation, though specific memories are usually forgotten. Another thing I noticed when reading The Afterlife Unveiled is the sharp similarity between some channeled accounts and the accounts given by the hypnotically regressed patients of Michael Newton and other therapists interested in between lives memories. Typically, these patients describe an afterlife environment that is more abstract and unearthly than Summerland accounts, while saying that their own bodily forms are essentially patterns of light and color. As I wrote in an older post, there also is very little discussion, in Michael Newton's accounts, of what has been called paradise or Summerland, the earth-like environment of the afterlife, featuring gardens, meadows, houses, birds, etc. Some of Newton's subjects do recall studying in a beautiful library, but for the most part the afterlife environment, as they depict it, seems to consist of blobs of color, which are souls, zipping around in a rather abstract geometric setting. It reminds me a little of the old sci-fi movie Tron. Newton's patients also report being part of a group Soul A, an organizational unit that allows spirits to learn from each other and make progress together. Compare all this with the discussion of reincarnation in another of Betty's sources, A The Road to Immortality, channeled by Geraldine Cummins and published in 1932. Complete text online here. The Communicating Spirit, allegedly famed psychical researcher F.W.H. Myers, tells us that on the fourth spiritual plane the spirit acquires a body entirely dissimilar from the human body. As regards appearance, it can only be described as being apparently a compound of light and colors unimaginable. The shape of this form is influenced by all the ego's past acts so far as they have impressed themselves on his deeper consciousness. This colored compound may be grotesque, bizarre in form, may be lovely beyond words, may possess strange absurdities of outline, or may transcend the loftiest dream of earthly beauty, a broken bar. Within the subtle world of which I speak, you will perceive a variety of forms which are not known on earth and therefore may not be expressed in words. Yet there is a certain similarity, a correspondence between the appearances on this luminiferous plane. Flowers are there, but these are in shapes unknown to you, exquisite in color, radiant with light. Such colors, such lights are not contained within any earthly octave, are expressed by us in thoughts and not in words, a broken bar. Betty summarizes the book's presentation of the group soul concept. Myers introduces us to the group soul, one of the hallmarks of the fourth plane. A group soul is a number of souls all bound together by one spirit. There are countless group souls, each headed and inspired by a single spirit of uncommon power. Each group soul might contain as few as 20 souls or as many as 1,000. And there is some unifying interest, for example music, that acts as the thread that binds the group together. A broken bar. Most group souls significantly quicken progress. Myers is himself a member of one. AOE. The interesting feature of my state here is that I am within a larger mind, and many of my affinities are contained in it. A. He tells us we will AOE realize how fine and beautiful is this brotherhood within the one being, how it deepens and intensifies existence, how it destroys the cold selfishness so necessary to an earth life. A. Of special interest is the economy of the group soul. Each soul is so privy to the experiences of its fellows that the lessons normally learned only by a succession of many reincarnations can be speeded up. It works like this. A broken bar. What the Buddhists would call the karma I had brought with me from a previous life is, very frequently, not that of my life, but of the life of the soul, in my group, that preceded me by many years on earth and left for me a pattern which made my life. I, too, wove a pattern for another of my group during my earthly career. We are all of us distinct, Though we are influenced by others of our community on the various planes of being, A. Myers tells us he will not reincarnate. The surrogate experiences of his brothers and sisters, which he feels with as much intensity as if he were the actor, are teaching him all the remaining lessons of Earth needed for his advancement. Another point made by Newton's patients is that they plan out their earthly lives before birth, even choosing their parents. Yet the vicissitudes of life and the vagaries of free will mean that the plan A, mostly forgotten by the conscious mind while incarnated A, is often not carried out successfully. This idea is paralleled in Betty's excerpts from Testimony of Light, 1980, by Helen Greaves, a book of material purportedly originating with a deceased nun, Frances Banks. Note that Greaves' book was published 14 years earlier than Newton's first book, Journey of Souls. Here is how the life plan is described by Frances Banks. Somewhere in the deeps of my mind, 2A blueprints at TM are brought forward into my consciousness. These are so clear that I can, literally, take them out, materialize them and study them. One is the perfect idea with which my spirit went bravely into incarnation. The other is the resultant of only a partially understood plan, a broken bar. In fact, my life as it was actually live a broken bar. First of all, the mind looks at the whole comparison, and sets the blueprints side by side. This is the first shock, a true humbling of yourself to find that you did so little when you would have done so much, that you went wrong so often when you were sure that you were right. During this experience, the whole cycle of your life term unfolds before you in a kaleidoscopic series of pictures. During the crisis, one seems to be entirely alone. Yours is the judgment. You stand at your own bar of judgment. You make your own decisions. You take the blame. A broken bar, you are the accused, the judge and jury. Readers of Newton's accounts obtained from hypnosis sessions will find this description strikingly familiar. And here is Francis on the group soul: whilst I was meditating in my golden garden, I found myself transported a TM to a broken bar, a cluster of entities about a teacher. Immediately I experienced a rise of consciousness, an upsurge of joy, a mingling of unity and harmony which colored my whole being. I cannot explain this in any of the terms, though I doubt whether they will have the same connotation for you. I knew this was right for me. I had come into my own. There was no definite acceptance. The entire operation was unobtrusive and simple, yet I had the conviction that all was well, that I was amidst my fellow travelers on the way. This upsurge of joy and sense of belonging are typical of the reactions of Newton's hypnotized patients, often expressed in highly emotional terms. Finally, it's worth mentioning a little-known channeled book called The Afterlife of Leslie Stringfellow, which Betty discusses in one of his early chapters. Stringfellow died in 1886. Thereafter, his mother obtained 15 years of mediumistic communication allegedly from him. Eventually, she wrote up the best of these and published just 100 copies of the resulting book, which she called Leslie's Letter to His Mother. Betty writes, "Leslie's letter to his mother was lost to the world until a librarian at the University of Arkansas, Stephen Chisholm, stumbled across a copy and was so intrigued by it that he undertook to bring it out in a new edition, 2005, with the title The Afterlife of Leslie Stringfellow." What does Leslie say about reincarnation? I'm not sure. I did not see it mentioned in Betty's overview, but in his last chapter, Betty reports, one of our seven sources, Benson/Borgia, says nothing about reincarnation, and even implies that it doesn't occur. The other six do mention it, and five of those six endorse it. Benson, Borgia refers to the famous book by Antony Borgia, Life in the World Unseen, 1956. Presumably, then, the Stringfellow book does contain some discussion of reincarnation, and given its early date and near total obscurity, I'd be interested to know what it says.